Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to WMRW, and this is Amy, and I am here for the 5-H show. And the 5-H's stand for health, happiness, harmony, humor, and humanity. And I have a live guest in the studio today, and I am very excited today because we are celebrating freedom. We decided that we should have this as close to the 4th of July as possible for this interview because today I am interviewing Caleb Teske, who has come here from Morrisville today. And Caleb is a journalist. I actually met him at one of the statehouse rallies. He was sitting there next to me with his recorder. I had my recorder, and I was like, hey, what's up? We started talking, and I said, wow, I have been looking for someone who is a cannabis legalization guru to come on the show here. And I couldn't have found someone with a broader point of view and a broader perspective, because Caleb has actually been doing a deep dive for, I don't know how long, at least the last few years into the subject. It seems to be your primary subject right now as a journalist. So thanks for coming on the show, Caleb.
Thanks, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here. It's been about 2.5 years since I started covering this. I don't know if you can give me some vocals in my headphones, but I can't hear
those
myself.
Those are a little funky.
Okay, that's all right. There we go. Oh, that sounds a little... There we go. All right, cool. Yeah, it's been about 2.5 years, and it was a pleasure meeting you at the State House. I've really enjoyed coming out to check out those rallies that James Ellers has been putting together, and I always like watching a John Rogers speech, so it was a pleasure meeting you there, and thank you for having me here today. It's a beautiful day.
Yes, it is, and it's a beautiful ride. We were just talking about that, how gorgeous this area is, Waitsfield. It's so nice to come here, and Warren. So this has been a subject I've been very interested in for a long time. I go way back to, like, the hemp movement. That's when I got involved, like, with politics a little bit, when rural Vermont was really working on those, on getting hemp legal to grow here in Vermont, right? Hemp, which is, like, the kind of paper that the Declaration of Independence is written on. I mean, we all know kind of the history of how hemp has been used for food, fuel, and fiber, you know, for so long. And so it was very exciting when we were finally able to grow it here in Vermont. But I do know that it did not turn out the way we expected with the hemp industry. So should we maybe start with that?
Sure. Yeah. And again, I don't want to give the impression that I'm a guru. I don't know if I love that
well,
term.
You have an eagle's eye view, I think, from all the people you have interviewed. Caleb can be found online if you search for him, The Fine Print Journalism. He's got a YouTube page, an Instagram. You can find interviews he's done with all sorts of cannabis growers and people in the industry.
Yeah. And you know, the hemp market, so based on the people that I've spoken with here in Vermont, including my old high school science teacher, Dave Williams from Linden Institute, you know, the hemp market started out very hot. It was this, you know, sort of brave new world kind of thing where it's like, oh, we're going to start legalizing something that should have been legal a long time ago. And it seems like what happened was that the state issued so many licenses in such a short period of time that, you know, the market was hot for a year or two maybe, and then it just the price dropped off a table. And as David Williams told me, he couldn't give the stuff away once the price compression happened, and he was just out like burning it in a field, which is unfortunate to hear, you know, because there's so many good things that you could do with hemp plants. However, it also seems like, you know, based on those interviews, that there's a major bottleneck in the processing of hemp. You can grow a lot of hemp. However, the machinery required to process it, I think it is called like a decorticator or something like that. They're very expensive, and you can only cram so much biomass into the machine at one time. And so, kind of put all of the power dynamics in that relationship between the grower and the processor all favored the processor, because without them, the growers can't do anything with the material. So, and there were some scam artists running around. I know in the Northeast Kingdom, this guy basically fleeced a bunch of people, made a bunch of false promises, and then took off with their material, never processed it. So that was unfortunate to see. And I think we're going to see maybe a similar thing happen with the legal cannabis game here. Hopefully not as drastic, because I, from what I recall, I think about 90% of the hemp companies folded after the price drop happened. And, you know, I talked to John Rogers about this at length, and he certainly could give you more details when you bring him on the show. I can't wait to hear that either, Amy.
Yeah. 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 So, spoiler alert here. I'm going to have John Rogers I'm only kidding. I'm going to have John Rogers on next week.
Awesome.
Who's running for lieutenant governor. So that would be great to ask him more about, because I do remember running into a lot of farmers around that time, right when hemp was first legalized, and they were all jumping on. They were like, wow, this is going to save my farm. And I just hate to see farmers. I mean, we can't afford to lose any more farms. This is just horrifying.
Yeah, and a lot of them bet the farm on that and lost, which is, it's definitely unfortunate to see that, you know.
Right. So where is the legislature on this? Are they working on that issue anymore? Is that sort of off the plate?
It seems like the hemp stuff is less important now that we have the recreational, you know, legal cannabis market. However, there are still tweaks being made to the farm bill. And if you ask John about this, one thing that was interesting that he said was, you know, he said, when I had a hemp farm, I couldn't get a cannabis license. And now that I have a cannabis license, they took away my hemp license. So you should ask him about that, because that was a, you know, it seems like if you're legally able to grow one, you should be able to grow the other, or both at the same time. I don't know. It's kind of the same plant. So that seems silly to me, but for sure, it seems like the legislature has pivoted to mostly focusing on, you know, the tax revenue that they take in from the recreational market.
Right. Yeah. And it, you know, getting back to kind of when I came into this movement, you know, it did just always seem silly to me. It was a plant. And here we are regulating something that could be as abundant as zucchini. You know, we should be tripping over it. We should be giving it away. It's like, it's so, in some ways, you know, can be very easy to grow if we just get out of the way, right? Mm. And let folks do that. So I'm thinking back to, I'm calling it BC now, before COVID, right? Before COVID, just a year or two before, they legalized first it started with growing it, right? People were first and foremost allowed to grow it, give it away, right? But not sell it.
Right. The home grow. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I thought was beautiful, because right. it really took like the whole mob out of it. It took the whole corporate ownership out of it. It really just brought it back down to farmers and growers and real homespun activities. Mm. But then COVID came, and I sort of took my eye off the ball. I wasn't hearing as much about it, which is why I was so excited when I ran into you, because, like, what's happened since then? The legislature during COVID, I think, right, legalized sale of cannabis for consumption to get high, right?
Right, and I don't remember the exact date on that. I remember they started issuing licenses in May of, what is it, 2 years ago now, somewhere in there. And before that, you know, it was a little before I started looking at this. So I'm not entirely sure what the legislature was doing during that time. I know that Phil Scott really pushed this. You know, I feel like we could have had legalization 5 years before it happened. But he kept kicking the can down the road with these ideas of, oh, we need roadside saliva testing and things like that, which doesn't even exist. And so I really thought he was just stalling, and some of the results of that push, you know, were some of these DUI laws the cannabis DUI laws, which we could talk about if you want, but I think we're just based on, I'll pull up the language sign here, bunk science, and really just not backed by anything with any type of scientific consensus behind it, which was unfortunate. But that's what he kept demanding, was the roadside, the safety testing. And now, you know, they've sent all these police in Vermont to drug recognition expert trainings, which are super expensive from what I understand. And even if you ask Dr. Mark Levine from Department of Health on camera at an advisory committee meeting, he admitted that there is no scientific consensus to what constitutes impairment from cannabis. So it kind of begs the question, well, why are you training police officers now to detect signs of impairment from cannabis when your own medical expert has just said there is no there's no way to detect that. So that kind of stuff really bothers me a lot. It seems like just another reason for cops to harass motorists, in my opinion.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. So that was a big concern. How has it turned out? I mean, it's been a couple years now. Are there increases? Is anybody talking about that? Are there increases in accidents or?
You know, they've tried to do these studies. There was one that the Department of Health here in Vermont loves to quote, and I believe it's from Colorado. There aren't many. There was a couple. And one was from Colorado where they tried to say that was the hypothesis of the study was that when you legalize cannabis, there's going to be an increase in accidents because people are driving while they're high or whatever. However, I thought those studies were flawed. And, you know, I'm not the best scientist, but I did go to engineering school. I have a good idea of how science is done and how to read through scientific research papers and things like that. And they left a lot of things out of those studies. Like, and this was during COVID when they did the study. Back to your point. So one of the things that happened during COVID was that the government started allowing people to take drinks home from bars, to-go cocktails.
Yeah, with straws.
Right. And so I was...
which I thought was a little...
So I've been bartending, which I thought was odd. You know, mm-hmm. The whole point is this liability thing where you can't send people home with a, you know, like a scorpion bowl in a liter jar. But that's exactly what they did. And this study was happening during that time frame. Oh. And it says, okay, well, maybe you didn't also account for the fact, yes, Colorado did legalize cannabis. And yes, there was an increase in car accidents. Those two things are true. However, they leave out the point about how they were giving people alcohol to take with them out of restaurants and bars. And also, one thing they left out was the population growth of Colorado, and specifically Denver, which is one of the fastest growing cities in the country, I believe. And naturally, if you have more people driving cars, you're going to have more accidents. And if you have more people driving with alcoholic beverages in the car, you know, those are things that I felt should have been factored into the study. And I do think now we're seeing some studies come out saying, and even the conclusion of that study, by the way, mentioned at the end, it said we were not able to substantiate our hypothesis. So the Department of Health likes to leave that part out, but it was unproven. And other studies we're seeing, which, you know, suggested that in legal states we'd see more kids using cannabis. Those are being debunked. So I just think a lot of that stuff is just, it's just garbage science. That's more of the sort of fear tactics and the reefer, like lingering reefer madness that we're seeing still from, you know, history that just won't go away.
Right. And even if there could be an, you know, an increased risk, putting it in perspective compared to, like, say, cell phones, or like now my new car has this digital screen. I can't even scan the radio without pressing four different buttons that I have to take my eyes off the road. And I think, wow, are we worried about safety? You know, I mean, there are other things, you know, going on here. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your story here, Caleb. How did you end up becoming a journalist?
Well, so it was kind of just on a whim. You know, I'm a big Hunter S. Thompson fan. And I've had a lot of little side projects. I used to produce music for a while. I was making hip hop beats, and then I did stand up comedy for a number of years. And I kind of got in some trouble there because I have a, well, you know, language. and I needed a new passion project. And I had this one friend named Riley Hayes who kept saying, hey, man, I really like your writing. Maybe you should try journalism sometime. And I kind of just got sick of him saying that. So I was like, you know, maybe I will. And I think, you know, the story with my dad getting arrested when I was seven, he was arrested with Billy Greer in what was at the time the largest drug seizure in Vermont history. And they were smuggling hash across the Canadian border. And they all ended up doing federal prison time. I think that probably, I mean, it took a while for me to process how serious that was. But, you know, we saw him get arrested on the Channel 3 News by the FBI when I was seven, which was, you know, when you're seven, that doesn't really register. But when you're like 15 years old, you're like, whoa, that was kind of a huge deal. And they've written books about, this guy wrote a book called Hashtag, an old writer for the Burlington Free Press, which I think is a cheesy title. But for sure that, you know, and we grew up around a lot of old hippies who just were growing cannabis in the garden. My best friend's dad used to just have weed plants in the garden, and You know, he would smoke joints and, you know, he'd be like, oh, one of his cigarettes smells funny. It was never a big deal. And honestly, when I started this project, I had an idea of doing like a broader mix of issues, but I really got sucked into this when I started interviewing, you know, growers. And I see you had one pulled up there, Tim Fair, who is a lawyer from Vermont Cannabis Solutions. That's one of my real early interviews right off the bat. And Tim had a lot of great insights onto the industry. And I just found myself getting really sucked into this. And I still have done, you know, like I've had local musicians, and I just had my friend Evan Carlson on from NEK Broadband talking about expanding internet access to rural Vermont. But the cannabis stuff has just, the bulk of my interviews are cannabis. And I just, I got onto it, and I was like a dog with a bone, you know.
And that was about two and a half years ago. Or
yeah,
so.
I started in December of 2021, so it was a little over 2.5 years ago. And I actually spent 4 months just doing research and reading the legislation and watching through cannabis control board meetings and advisory committee meetings, which is not the most fun stuff. And honestly, I almost gave up before I even got into this, because after reading the legislation, I was just so disappointed. I was like, man, this is everything that I imagined, all the terrible things I imagined it would be, and then some extra stuff that I didn't even imagine. And, you know, I think the legislation was well-intentioned, but ran through a bunch of committees that don't really understand the subject matter. And, you know, peace to John Rogers again, who was one of the lead sponsors on S-54. But some of the provisions that were placed into this legislation were just maddening, and I almost quit. But I met some really good people that put me in touch with a great network of other local business owners here, and that kind of gave me the encouragement I needed to keep digging on this.
Wow. Well, fantastic. I am speaking today with Caleb Teske. His site is The Fine Print. The Fine Print Journalism, and you can find him on YouTube. You can find these interviews that he's talking about, and he's here from Morrisville today. And so what were some of those points in this legislation? I mean, that's what I'm curious. I feel like legislation is just a draft always. We can always go back. We should go back and tweak it over time. What do you think could use some tweaking? What should we focus on?
Well, personally, I thought they should have tweaked it more before they passed it.
Yeah, that would have been ideal.
I think it's always harder to fix things after the fact than when the government's involved than to do it right the first time. However, when the government is involved, it also seems incredibly difficult to do it right the first time. So it's kind of you're kind of in a pickle there. So some of the big issues, really, one of the big ones is potency caps, THC caps. And I believe there's only one other state in the country that has this. I think it's Connecticut.
Oh.
So they said, and this was pushed by the Department of Health, again, with Mark Levine and the Vermont Medical Society and the Vermont Psychiatric Association, which were kind of just offshoots of like some of his friends. There was a couple other one. There was like four little nonprofit groups, and they would show up to all these meetings, and they were pushing for potency cap on flower of 15% THC content originally, and they didn't want to allow concentrated products at all. I don't want to say we either, because I wasn't involved in any of the advocacy work, but people had to, you know, basically beg, and nobody in the industry wants THC caps. It's ridiculous. You know, most really top-notch flower now is testing at 30%, sometimes a little over 30%. So to put a cap, they wanted it to be at 15. They compromised at 30, which is good for flower, but the concentrates, they put a cap at 60%. And some of these concentrates are testing well above that now. So it came down to a question of, are manufacturers going to have to go back and like retool their entire manufacturing process that they've maybe been dialing in for, who knows, years, decades, some of them. So that was a real bummer. They did lift the concentrate cap on liquid concentrates, so for like distillate vaporizer cartridges. But for hash and hash rosin and products like that, they still have those caps in place. And that's one of the major things that people would like to see go away, at least the people I've interviewed. And personally, the stuff that bothers me is, you know, so like retailers, right, are subjected to, and this is something the state can't really handle, this is a federal thing, but these 280E tax codes. And if you the interview with Tim Fair I did there, Tim was the first one to bring this up to me, and he said that, so basically, and I'm not a tax expert here, please guys, but the 280E tax codes make it so that cannabis retail establishments can't write off any costs like a normal business can. And according to what Tim told me, what was that, about 2 years ago, he said that could raise the effective tax rate on a cannabis dispensary to somewhere in the range of 70%.
Whoa. With no write-off.
Right.
Oh, my goodness.
So if that would go away, I think that would free up a lot of cost on the dispensaries and maybe help keep the prices down, because the margins are so slim when you're running a dispensary, you know. You're either forced to like not make any money or jack up the prices a little more than you normally would to cover the difference. We may see the 280E tax codes go away if rescheduling ever happens, which I know the federal government has been talking about for quite some time now. But that even that could take some time. And in that time, I'm sure we're going to see some people going out of business just because they can't. You know, and I've talked to some dispensary owners here who have told me how much they're paying in taxes every year, and it's just, it's absurd. It's like you could buy a new house and a couple of vehicles every year with the money they're paying in taxes. So that was a big one for me. You know, there's also just a lot of ticky-tacky rules, like you're not allowed to advertise. I think the advertising rules are absolutely ridiculous, and that's something the state could totally change if they wanted to. You know, you can advertise alcohol. There's a million different, you know, nicotine vape cartridges at every gas station you go to. And, it's just crazy that you can't advertise cannabis. If you want to advertise, there's a silly rule where, any advertisement you put up, you have to be able to guarantee that over 85% of the people who are going to see that advertisement are over the age of 21. So it really just kind of, it crushes the ability for people to advertise almost anywhere, including on social media. You know, I've seen people having their Instagram accounts banned just for posting, not even saying, hey, we're selling this for $50, just like posting pictures of their products, which are in a legal state here. So the social media is definitely also lagging behind on this. You know, I think if you're in a legal state, you should be able to post whatever you want. If you have a license, boom, hey, we got these products. Here's our flower. Here's our concentrates. Here's a list of dispensaries we're in, stuff like that. I think that's really hindering business. And I do have a couple of unconfirmed rumors that someone might be suing the state regarding these advertising rules here soon, which I'd personally love to see. And, you know, just some of the... You know, so like your employees have to have an ID card, which means they have to get a federal background, an FBI background check. You have to go get fingerprinted. And, you know, which is, you know, it's an extra like $150 for every employee.
Is that at dispensaries and growers?
Everybody.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And if you're the owner of the business, your background check costs $500. Originally, it was supposed to be like $150. Then the state ended up outsourcing the background checks to a third party. Which cost everyone $500. So some people had already done their background checks and then had to go do them again, which was just ridiculous. It's cheaper for your employees, but for the owners, it's like $500 and you got to get fingerprinted, which I think is ridiculous. That's what you do to convicted felons. You know, so it's just, there's a lot of hidden fees here. The product registration, we might be the only state with product registration. So every time, let's say you have a grow house and you've got 10 different strains. First of all, you got to pay for testing. Testing, a full panel test on one strain, I think, is still running about $500. So if you've got 10 different strains, that's $5,000 right there. And, you know, for people that want to, most of the growers that I really like, they don't want to just grow one strain. They don't want to monocrop and turn it into the corn industry or something like that. They want to have a variety because that's what the customers like. So that's extra cost. And then the product registration at the back end, for every product, it's like $50 after you've paid for all the testing. Now it's $50 for all 10 again. So that's another $500. And then you've got to upload them to the portal and wait for them to approve the registration for your product, even if it's a product you've already run before. And there's just also a lot of paperwork. Every 2 weeks, these growers have to update everything they're doing in the grow house, from the amendments they're using to any type of IPM products.
What's IPM?
Pest management, integrated pest management. So like any of the approved pesticides or fungicides or things like that, you have to punch this information into the state website every 2 weeks. And it's just, some of the folks I know have had to basically hire a full-time employee just to do all the paperwork, which is, you know, taking more money out of their pockets. And it really seems like, along with the DUI laws, which is one of my biggest personal beefs, which I think is just total garbage, you know, all of these things are just, it's, I call it death by a thousand cuts, you know, where it's just nickels and dimes, and then it adds up into dollars and stacks of dollars. And I really feel like this was geared towards, and Vermont has done a decent job of keeping out the larger corporations like a lot of this other states have done, but I just feel like a lot of these regulations are geared to favor people with more money to cover all of those costs and kind of just wait it out until everyone else goes out of business and the market consolidates, like we see all around the country.
Right. And I was going to ask you about that, too, how we've seen this play out in other states. It seems like same stuff, different state.
Absolutely. Well, and that's because, in my opinion, all of the states have basically hired these same consultants, these Vicente Cederberg, Vicente Strategies consultants. And so Vicente Cederberg was one of the first powerhouse cannabis law firms in the country. They have a consulting arm of their law firm called Vicente Strategies, although now Cederberg has left to go to the psychedelics industry and probably try to mess that up as well. But those those guys were hired in states across the country. And honestly, I watched through a lot of their meetings that they sat in with here with the advisory committee and the control board. And it's clear that they're not cannabis folks either. They're lawyers, and they were trying to make money. And from what I saw. And so the idea was, hey, we'll try legalization in one state, right? And then we'll fix the mistakes in the next state. And then by the time we get over here, it'll be good and we'll learn from all the mistakes. But what I've seen is the opposite, where they've taken all the same, you know, quote unquote mistakes and repeated them across the country, which sort of makes me think maybe they're not mistakes. Maybe this is part of the system that they've built here, and it's designed to, for people to fail and to favor big corporations. Vermont, I think, honestly, is sort of separate. I will say, I think Vermont is one of the most favorable states to start a cannabis company in, although I still think that's not good. But I don't think this is a big enough market where a lot of those big companies like Curaleaf and Trulieve and, you know, GTI and these big scale, you know, MSOs, I don't think they're particularly interested in this market. There's just not that much money to be made here. Although I think that's a good thing. I think that could leave room for all of some of the excellent craft growers that we have here to thrive. And I do think people in Vermont do sort of appreciate sort of smaller localized business models. But for sure, in states around the country, we've seen the same thing happen. They open up legalization. Everybody's happy for a couple years. Then the price drops, a bunch of people go out of business. And then like in California, you know, you've got the wholesale price of cannabis has dropped down. I mean, it was down to $300-$400 a pound for outdoor. If that was the wholesale price here in Vermont, I think pretty much every outdoor grower would go out of business. But then you see other things like people from California taking that cheap weed and smuggling it back across the country and sneaking it into legal markets where they can sell it for 4 or 5 times that much. So it creates a whole bunch of problems. And I don't know what the answer is to that, but it seems like every state market gets saturated and the price drops and then it consolidates and you see the people with deep pockets, you know, buying up the distressed assets.
Right. Oh, wow. Thank you. This is a breath of fresh air, Kael. This is exactly what I wanted to hear, what I was interested in. Thank you for this big, broad scope. We're speaking today with Caleb Teske, the Fine Print Journalism, and he's been doing deep dives as a journalist into this subject of cannabis legalization. And that was exactly my main question was, you know, when we started, this was a dream of food, fiber, fuel, farmers in Vermont, homegrown, kind of dropping the price so it'd be more more affordable, and we could make products in our kitchens to sell, because everybody wants to make different herbal remedies and different herbal potions and things and lotions and food and everything. How is it going for the small scale, what we envision, the small scale growers here in Vermont and producers? Are they making it in this market?
I think it's still just a little too early to make that call. However, from the folks I've talked to, it's a mixed bag. And it's definitely tough sledding for everybody. Even the people that I think have some of the best product in Vermont, and especially after this winter, which was not a particularly good winter for Vermont. It wasn't a lot of tourism. Everybody's sales were going downhill. And with the amount of cultivation licenses that the state issued, it's been tough, especially for folks who don't already have that established brand. The people who came in right at the beginning, who had a foothold, who did some good marketing, those folks are doing all right. However, when you got 400 cultivation licenses and there's, 60, 70 dispensaries in Vermont now, there's a lot of product to choose from. So, a lot of people, I think, I don't want to say a lot, but a good number of people, like, for example, at Forbin's Finest, they decided to just open their own dispensary, which I think is a smart move for people. They still have a lot of other outlets, but I know a lot of people in Maine went that route as well when we saw just the explosion of cultivation licenses, because it was impossible to get your product into a dispensary because all the dispensaries had their own cultivation facility and they're just selling their own product. So everyone started opening their own dispensaries, which I think is a smart move. Guys like, I'll give a shout out to Ben Wilcox. I really like Ben from Off Piece Farms. He's up in Sutton. Ben's a great guy. He's done a lot of advocacy as well. Grows a really nice product. He's a homesteader. He's off grid. He's got solar panels and battery packs. He's doing all the right things, and he's really well respected. And his brand is recognized. And Ben even said, yeah, man, it's tough out here. And I think at a certain point you have to look at, if guys like that are having a hard time, like maybe there are systemic problems with the program, as opposed to just like, because I think Ben's a really sharp business guy. Mm-hmm. He's making all the right relationships, and his herb is super nice, which I think is the most important thing. You can be kind of a butthead, and if your weed is good, you could still get along. But he's a great guy with a great product, doing things the right way. And he said it's still tough out here. So I think that's an indicator that for sure we have systemic issues here that are holding back small businesses. And I don't think that's unique to the cannabis industry. I think that's unique to every kind of agriculture, and which I talked to John Rogers about, who I also had on the show for a great interview. And I think John said, the grower spends the most amount of time with the plant and makes the least amount of money of anyone who touches it. And I agree with John on that point. I think that's really unfortunate. Mm-hmm. And I think that the health of the market should be judged by how the small growers are doing. And if they're not doing well, problems should be addressed drastically.
Yes.
It's going to be tough. I think the next year or year and a half, especially after this outdoor season last year, was awful for the outdoor growers with all the flooding. People lost their shirts. So I think this year, the next 18 months are really going to be telling. And we've already seen about 70 licensees in Vermont not renew their licenses.
Wow.
And if you go on the CCB website, they have a list of all the licenses. And that was, 70 doesn't sound like a lot, but there was only like 500 in the state. So that's a pretty good chunk. That's, 15% or so of people that are not renewing, which might actually help the people that are remaining, might help stabilize the prices. But it's also an indicator that, people are struggling out here.
Right. Yeah. So if I go into a dispensary here in Vermont, how much of what's in there is Vermont product?
All of it.
Oh, okay.
Except for the CBD and stuff like that.
Okay.
They do have some CBD products from out of state, which is perfectly legal now under the Farm Bill. But all of the cannabis, all of the recreational stuff, adult use, mm-hmm. 100% of that is grown in Vermont. Or it should be, legally.
The phone did ring, and I was about to open it for callers.
Oh,
so
call
somebody
yeah.
just read my mind. But I think they stopped. I have the phone in my hand, and I have the directions handy here. If you want to call in, definitely, and ask a question, you can call 802-496-4951. That's 802-496-4951. And it is July 7th, and we are celebrating Independence Day today here on the 5-8 Show with Caleb Teske to give an update to our listeners on the cannabis legalization situation. So call back, or someone new, call in with a question. Because one of my questions... Oh, here we go. Let me pull this person up. Hold on. Hello? Hi. Sure, let me press a couple buttons. Hold on. Hello, caller? Are you there? Oh, push the top button. There we go. Hello, caller?
Hello, how are you?
We're doing great. How are you today?
Very good. Enlightening conversation and something that definitely needs to be talked about. I was involved and went to a lot of the meetings on the State House in the beginning, and the whole thing, regulation is fine, but they wanted to just tax and license and just put too many fees into the product. And there was a group also that wanted to limit the amount of people that were able to sell. They wanted to basically have four people roughly that were going to control, which people weren't into that. But the whole thing is, what I told them is, when you tax and you do all this, one, if you're worried about quote-unquote black market, you're not going to get rid of that. And that's the way most people are going to go. And still people buy their weed that way because, you know, you have people that you know, you trust and all that stuff. So they're really not making it to where it's user-friendly to go in and buy it because the prices are higher, but then also the farmers aren't getting paid either, you know, when they're having to sell it somewhere else. And then there's all, again, the fees. Like, you're talking about fingerprinting to get employees. That's just a whole another fee that adds on to it. And it doesn't make anything safer, you know, you think?
Yeah, I'll take that if you don't mind, Amy.
Mm-hmm. Nope.
Yeah, spot on. Caller, so I'm still one of those people that buys all my weed on the black market. I just can't afford these dispensary prices, and you know, the taxes are certainly, the 280E tax code that I mentioned earlier is a federal level thing. However, the state taxes, you know, it's a 20% tax, which I think is ridiculous. Alcohol is, oh, go ahead, you got something else? Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, basically 20% is ridiculous, and that's what I told them, because the 10% is ridiculous on the liquor and rooms and meals, whatever, 9% and all that stuff. You tax it so much, people are going to go out of state. If they want to go the legal way, they're going to go to, I mean, people go to Massachusetts, you know, already.
Or Maine.
Because of the cheapness, you know, and it's just like, you're just making something too difficult, and they just want to tax everything.
Well, and so, I think the state's main concern is generating tax revenue. I don't think they cared about making this safe or, you know, if they cared about getting rid of the black market, like you said, man, they wouldn't be taxing it so high. They'd be making this much easier for people to get licenses. And seriously, if it was cheaper to go to a dispensary, I'd go support. I have a number of friends that run dispensaries, and I love what they're doing. I just can't afford to pay you $50 for an eighth of weed when I could go up the road to my buddy's house and get an ounce for $150. I'm just never going to do that. And for sure, even James Pepper, the chairman of the CCB, has had to admit that some of these rules are just handing a gift to the black market. And their whole mission, they said, was to eliminate the black market. But I think it was really just to take in tax revenue, personally.
Oh, totally. And the farmers that are trying to make a go at it, doing all the steps and all the legalities and all that stuff, I mean, they're working their butts off for basically no return, like any other farming, be it dairy or vegetables or even meat. You know, it's made so difficult that they're not going to make money. And you can cut them some tax breaks, but when you're doing all this other stuff to burden them and make their workday even longer than it already is, just dealing with this stuff is insane.
Sure, and to your point, you know, we've seen the same thing happen in the dairy industry here in Vermont, especially after, you know, Unilever bought out Ben & Jerry's, and after
yep.
Agrimark bought out Cabot. I mean, look at the following decade after that and see how the industry consolidated and how many family farms went out of business. You know, you can only squeeze so much blood out of a stone before they don't have the money to continue operating, which is very unfortunate, you know. And, you know, then we've seen these big companies in Unilever. I'm going to put the language sign up for this one again. Unilever, I think, is just a horribly run company with bad intentions, and they've ushered in all this, you know, chemical agriculture, consolidating confined feeding operations, all the atrazine and glyphosate usage. And I really hope we don't see a repeat of that in the cannabis industry. That would be unfortunate.
Well, they change what organic is also, you know, and then everything, again, you were talking about the smaller people getting bought out. It's the same old, you know. Capitalism is supposed to be, you know, have a variety of choices and competition and all that stuff. And the market is definitely glutted and the price has gone down, you know. But then again, if you're going to actually try to make a go at this up and up, they've made it impossible to succeed. Is the way I look at it. But thank you very much, and I'll let you all keep talking.
Appreciate you. Thanks for the questions, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks for calling. We are open. The phone line is open if anyone else has a question on July 7th for our live interview here with Caleb Teske, the fine print journalism. You can call us at 802-496-4951. That's 496-4951.
Maybe my mom's out there somewhere.
Yeah, maybe mine is too. I think. Yeah, this is a subject that across the generations, you know, people are interested in. We waited so long for legalization, and that's why I think it's really important that we really have a good hard conversation, hard look at how is it going.
And I think it's also a good look at how the government operates. You know, I feel like the last real massive emerging market was maybe like the tech boom back in the, you know, the late 90s there, like when the internet came around and people started having cell phones everywhere, and you saw a lot of the same stuff, you know, startups just going bust. The big Silicon Valley bubble just exploding, which we'll probably see something similar in the cannabis industry. But I think this is a good chance for people to, in case they haven't been paying attention prior to this, to see how the laws are being made, to see the kind of mistakes that are being repeated over and over again, and to see that, you know, a lot of the people that are writing these laws, and the lobbyists included, don't really know what they're talking about. The people who are getting appointed to the regulatory agencies don't really have any experience. You know, sorry to the CCB, but I thought they were all unqualified to be hired for that job. John Rogers applied to be on the Cannabis Control Board and didn't even get an interview. And this is a guy who spent 16 years as an elected official who literally helped write the bill on legalization. He is a hemp farmer. He owns a business. Who better to sit on the Cannabis Control Board than a guy who knows how to grow the plant and knows how the government works? And he didn't even get an interview. And it's like, if you're not going to interview a guy like that, who are you interviewing? And, you know, it just, things like that, people should really be paying attention to, because it makes me also wonder, you know, who's being put in charge of every other state agency? Are those people qualified? Or is this just the way hiring happens in Montpelier, where it's a backdoor handshake kind of deal, and somebody owed someone a favor, and now you've got a nice, cushy, you know, James Pepper makes $105,000 a year. He came into this with no experience in cannabis.
And what is he now?
He's the chairman of the Cannabis Control Board.
Oh, my goodness. And then they have to rely on these consultants, right, from Vicente Strategies. I'm going to look into who they are.
And also the other company was called the NACB, which is the National Association of Cannabis Businesses, which was made up of guys from the liquor industry and former state regulators from other states that are having their own serious problems right now. And I just, you know, they should have had more growers in the room. They should have had people who have sold weed on the black market or made hash before. Instead, they hired a bunch of lawyers and consultants that really don't know what they're talking about, and they ignored a lot of the advice that came from the people who do. There wasn't a single person who's ever grown weed who thought we should have THC caps. Not a single person suggested that. According to John, that came out of the House Government Ops Committee with Sarah Copeland Hanzus, who is now Secretary of State, she denied it in the paper, but John said he sat in there on the meetings when it happened. And, you know, then kind of when the opening day of legalization, she was in 7 days talking about how they brought us out of the dark ages. It's like, no, you passed this law. You put this this rule in that nobody wanted. Nobody in the industry wants that rule. I haven't met a single consumer that wants that rule. That only comes from the government, and you're not. I felt like some of the public comment periods, you know, people were showing up to meetings and taking time out of their days to like give input to the state and the regulatory agencies. And I feel like a lot of that was just ignored, which is incredibly unfortunate. If we listened to the people who knew what they were doing, I think the market would look completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And it would favor the small guys a lot more.
Right. And it's interesting you bring up the NACB has ties to the liquor industry, because this just keeps reminding me not only of same stuff, different state, but same stuff, different century. So if we go back 100 years, right, we had the prohibition of alcohol, which kind of knocked out, you know, legal retailers, brought it solely to the black market. That's when, you know, I've read different books about the history back then. That's when really the mob took over, grew to such immense strength and power. And so then when legalization came back, when it was then legal again to sell liquor, who was going to run that, right? So then it became monopolies of corporations. It's a highly addictive substance. And so, you know, I do have concerns. I'm a health educator, so I'm a health teacher. And I've talked with kids and adults of all ages, from all walks of life, about addiction, you know, and substance use for decades. And it's really, I've come around to talking about it as addiction. You know, addiction is the thing we want to avoid. People can become addicted to substances. They can become addicted to things like gambling and video games. You know, it's really about how addiction impacts your life. Mm. And of course, we want people to be informed, you know, of how addictive stuff is. You know, nicotine being like the most addictive substance on the planet.
Or so sugar, maybe.
Right. Oh, sure. Right. Sugar. Exactly. Mm. And knowing what's in our food, right? Knowing, having the label actually explain what it is. Those are the things that we're concerned about. And so, you know, I am worried about the high potency because of the things I've heard. So about and the things that I've seen in loved ones. So this is something I wanted to ask you about, too, is I see that folks that I love who were previously purchasing from the black market, you know, life's going along fine. Yeah, they smoke, but yeah, they got a life and they're functioning and everything's going great. But now this I'm wondering if it's the high potency stuff. They've really have sort of taken a nosedive. It's super expensive. First of all, they're going to these dispensaries. They're blowing all their money in a way they never did in years previously when they were buying it on the black market.
Sure.
I mean, they're and they seem more strung out, and they just seem and then some folks are slipping into heavier drugs, which wasn't even happening in the black market. So is this some of the super high potency? I'm talking about like the stuff that's concocted, you know, not necessarily
the
stuff
concentrates.
Yeah. What do you think? I mean, are there some concerns? How should I, as a health educator, I want to prepare youth, right, for this market, and I want them to be fully informed. You know, you want to be fully informed before you just try meth, right, sure. And don't know what you're in for, right? You want to be fully informed, right, of alcohol and whether that's impacting you and your family history, you know, and all of that. So the more information you have, the more you can avoid these kind of pitfalls in life. What do you think we should be telling people about this stuff?
Well, and that's a good question, Amy, and there certainly has been a lot of concerns raised by the Department of Health about, and they always like to use this line, it's not your grandma's cannabis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, there probably is some merit to that. If you go from not really using cannabis at all and jump straight into taking a fat dab of hash rosin, I remember the first dab I took, and I've been a regular user since I was, you know, a young teen. And the first dab I ever took was when I came home from college. I don't know, it was probably 7 or 8 years after that. I didn't even know what that was, and my buddy gave me a big one, and I...
Yeah, what is a dab?
A dab, like, that's a generic term for concentrated cannabis, so, like, any type of rosin product or diamonds, or there's all different ways that you can make concentrates, hydrocarbon extraction, solventless extraction, and that's just going to be a super concentrated form, and you get all the plant matter out of there, you're just left with the trichomes into THC, and so it's super pure. However, that can really rock your head. The first one I did, I sat on my buddy's couch just sweating and staring at the ceiling for a few hours. And, you know, for sure, if you're taking a massive dose of edibles you know, I've been taking edibles for, you know, 20 years now, and I still occasionally will eat too much, and it's uncomfortable. So the advice that I would give is you start low and slow. You know, if you're not used to using cannabis, maybe start with smoking a bowl or smoking a joint. And the good thing, I think, about the high potency stuff is that you don't need as much. So let's say you're used to smoking a whole joint by yourself, and that's what does the job for you. Well, if you get something that's like three times the potency, maybe you only need to smoke, you know, a third as much. And now you're not inhaling as much smoke into your lungs or burnt paper, which I do think there's some benefits to that. However, you know, there are people that are predisposed, I think, to mental health conditions that mm-hmm. really freak out from smoking weed. I've seen it happen. And it's, you know, I've seen people faint. I've seen people that kind of go into these, like, almost like they're having like a schizophrenic break or something, which I think is very rare. I think a lot of the hype behind this is hype. I think some of it's overhyped, and I don't think it's necessarily representative of the small fraction of people that that actually happens to. However, for those people, it can be very serious and uncomfortable. And for those people, you know, some people I don't think should use cannabis at all. Some people I think should be very careful when they consume it or consume a small amount, especially with the edibles. You got to be careful with the edibles. And I will say that even driving when you've eaten too many edibles can be dangerous. And it's not like alcohol, though, where I'm like, yeah, let's go drive. And it's like, oh, man, I need to sit on the couch for a few hours and, like, let this go away. But for sure, you know, for those people that are affected by cannabis on that level, you gotta go low, start low. I don't recommend just taking giant dabs if you're just coming in to this. Dabs still kick my butt pretty good. Yeah, another call.
Hello. Oh no, that's okay. Let me bring you back up. Hold on. Hello, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Oh, great, we can hear you.
You were talking about friends that started acting different and stuff. To me, like, okay, if something's 25%, yeah, it can knock you on your feet. And as your guest was saying, some people just shouldn't do it. And if you realize you shouldn't do it, just don't do it. Like alcohol, some people can't do that. But I'm finding an inconsistency with edibles as far as here they're saying it's this dose and then it does nothing. So then the person says, okay, didn't do anything this time, I'll do more. I mean, I've experienced that kind of stuff because it's like, oh, this is like kick ass. But everyone reacts different to it, and that's the whole thing. And the problem is what I'm finding when people go out drinking and then they don't know how to do edibles, then they'll pop a couple edibles and then they'll take a drink or two and then boom, they're like totally out of it. And it's education, and it's, I mean, people definitely should be responsible for themselves and stuff like that. But again, friends should be watching out for friends that never did before and really pay attention and try to explain to them how it works. It's the same as drinking. You're going to mess up. But usually it's better to mess up in a comfortable environment, you know?
Facts. And you're right about the alcohol. When you mix edibles and alcohol, it can get weird in a hurry.
Yeah, because I don't think the smoking's as bad in my belief. But again, everyone's different. That's the whole thing. And they're trying to get a one-size-fits-all. And then you were talking about, and this is what was happening in the very beginning, they're putting people in charge of something that know nothing about it. Like when the state police, they wanted them heavily involved. They know absolutely nothing about this. So why don't you get people that know something, put them with doctors and lawmakers and all that stuff, but really sit down and have a real conversation? Because I mean, some of the conversations they had in the beginning, I mean, it would go on for hours, but it's almost like people weren't listening to one another.
Well,
thinking it out and how we can go. It's how I can make out on this, or how we can get taxes on this, or how maybe we can stop this, you know. And the mental health thing, I mean, I know people, yeah, you just can't smoke it. And it's same with the alcohol or any drug, actually. Mm. And sugar, diabetes in this country, and obesity, I mean, let's be real.
Yep. Yeah, and, you know, some of the health and safety concerns by the state, I just think it really bothers me that we live in a state where they'll feed Adderall to a 7-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And we're sitting here arguing about whether or not cannabis is safe. You know, if you think it's okay to give amphetamine pills to children, I really don't want to hear your opinion on cannabis safety because it's irrelevant, and if you ask me.
Yeah, and it's the same with the regimen that they have kids on with vaccinations. I mean, it's like, sure, in order for you to do something, I mean, it's, again, you're pushing something on someone, and again, everyone reacts different. They try to make, regardless of whatever it is, a one-size-fits-all, which I understand you're trying to regulate it, but again, you have people that have no concept. Our legislators are people that are no different than us, and I look at what they've done this past session, and I'm appalled, and it's just, it's crazy, and it keeps on going. Again, but that's when people like you, myself, Amy, need to respond to them. Because if they don't hear response from people, they think they're doing a good job. But you're doing a great job, and I'll leave you again. Thank you very much.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Yeah, and that's why I think it's so important to have this conversation, because, you know, there have been actually increasing levels of psychotic breaks amongst youth lately, and what is it, right? What is it? Is it the Wi-Fi? Is it the vaccines? Is it the Adderall?
Well,
is it the dabbing?
Are the pharmaceutical drugs that kids are taking these days? You know, and that's another thing that I think gets left out of some of these cannabis studies, these health and safety studies. They say, oh, more kids are going to the hospital because of edibles. It's like, well, more kids are going to the hospital from adverse effects from pharmaceuticals, too. But where are all those, you know, scary stories in the media? You know, it's hard to judge if it's just the cannabis when seemingly everybody else is taking some other kind of pharmaceutical drug at the same time, you know?
Exactly. And how are we going to tease it apart? So the more we're willing to talk about it, you know, honestly, and I love the way that you were explaining that.
Thank you.
A really great way, because we need to start thinking about that. Mm-hmm. How are we going to explain it to these kids? Because it is really confusing right
now.
Well,
I don't have kids, and I did that on purpose because I don't want to have to explain stuff to
them.
I'm going to leave that to you, Amy.
Well, that's having done the kids show for so long, that's how you learn, though. You know what I mean? You don't know it till you have to explain it to someone else.
Sure.
And you did a great job today, Caleb.
Thank you.
You did fantastic. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah, we've been talking today with Caleb Teske, who is here from Morrisville, and he is author of The Fine Print Journalism. He is the journalist behind the Fine Print Journalism, and I recommend that folks check that out, please. If you're interested, he's done interviews with all sorts of cannabis growers and people involved in the industry, including John Rogers.
I had the whole control board on. I've had insurance agents. I've had politicians. I've had manufacturers, retailers, medical patients.
Wow.
The whole nine.
The perfect broad view. And I'm going to get this phone call, but let me just make a quick announcement. Can you hold on 1 second? Hello? Oh, okay. Hold on. Thanks. Just before the end of the show, I wanted folks to know that my previous guest, Elizabeth Brown, who's running for office in Waterbury, is having a town forum. She wants to hear from people, a community discussion on Wednesday, July 17th from 7 to 9 in the Waterbury Fire Station. So she was my guest last time. If you want to hear any of the previous interviews, you can go to amyvt.com. That's amyvt.com. I will have this interview up with Caleb soon. Caleb, thank you for joining me today.
Pleasure. Yeah.
Awesome. Have a great day, folks.